Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most revived work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
We're back, coming at you live after a brief hiatus last week. We're here to talk about Go For The Throat 23.3 and 23.4.
But before we get into that, a little bit of housekeeping. The fan art contest results are out. So they're on the subreddit, they're on our website, you can find them pretty much wherever. This was, I think, the most entries we've ever had, and they were fucking awesome. We even got a song. There's a lot of really cool shit in there, so go check it out.
Yeah.
Although the winner was a packed thing, so do be careful of, you know, spoilers in the winner. You might have to scroll past that one. But
there's a bit of, I guess it's worth pointing out, there's one that's Worm. Just one? I think just one that's Worm.
Just one, yeah.
Spoilers as well, but. Yeah, definitely check them out. There's some really cool stuff in there. My personal favorite is the one that's the horrification of Jillian, how her hair kind of turns into hands.
Yeah. Oh,
so good. Love that shit.
That's fun, because I think my favorite might have been the other Helen one, where she's in the middle of her ritual with the sticks.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
They're all really
great
good.
Great stuff. Yeah. But we're not here to talk about fan art today. No way. We're here to talk about Go For The Throat 23.3. We're in Avery's perspective, and it starts with Snowdrop's ascension to the Goblin Sage throne.
Finally, you know, the Game of Thrones is over.
I love how the first line of this is baptized in bin juice, and it pretty much immediately lets you know what's going on. It's a very fun way to immediately set the stage.
Yeah, and I don't know. Like, it's been pretty heavy recently, I guess, in the story with, like, Avery's little pelvic shattering and the parents. I don't know. It was just so fun that this chapter just kind of opens with a really fun tone. Like, as you say, just when the opening words are, like, baptized in bin juice, you're like, oh, this is going to be a fun time.
Yeah, exactly.
particularly good. For Snowdrop and Avery, who've, you know, really been through the ringer.
Yeah.
I don't know. Snowdrop, I feel like we talked about this when Avery first moved to Thunder Bay, but there was the whole, like, is this what's best for Snowdrop conversation? Like, I feel like we had back there, and so it's kind of nice that Avery's making more of an effort, I guess, after what Snowdrop just did for her. To really make sure Snowdrop's getting what she wants.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you think Snow is going to do as a Goblin Sage? Like, in a lot of ways, she seems like she's a really good fit, but then there are some goblins who definitely don't get it, right? So does that mean, what's it going to be like for them? Is she just going to have to give them the worst possible advice?
It seems like the ones who don't get it are, like, the cherry pop ones who are almost too stupid for it to matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know, especially with someone like Cherry, I feel like if you tell her to do something, she's gonna go do the opposite anyway, so it kind of cancels out. Like,
I see.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Toadslaw kind of brings it up, but like Snowdrop brings that, like, you know, youthful rebel energy that like someone like him doesn't have, and so it's like that's almost worth more despite the fact she says the opposite of what she means and some of them might not get it.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I'm kind of nervous that it means the shittiest goblins won't be able to, you know, get good advice. But maybe the Goblin Sage, it's not the right place for them to have gotten advice anyway.
Yeah. Like, there's a little more to the job than I guess I kind of realized. I guess I thought of it as like a bit of a rally point, like just basically a tool to call everyone into the same room and let people have town hall discussions or something. I didn't realize they actually gave out advice. So I don't know, we'll see. I thought the big thing here is, like, and as we get into the conversation with Toadslaw, Avery and Snowdrop are really talking about, like, oh yeah, she'll come in the evenings, like we'll just zip back and forth between Thunder Bay and Kennet. And this chapter kind of shows that's maybe not a super realistic. I think it's a bit of a through line in this chapter of, like, people questioning whether Avery is taking on too much as she is wont to do. And I feel like this chapter very explicitly sets up that she's biting off more than she can chew with this part here. Like, her and Snow are like, oh, yeah, it'll be fine. We'll just come in and Snowdrop can do evenings and whatever. But, like, it takes her a whole night to get back to Thunder Bay later on in this chapter. So I don't know that that's actually a reasonable expectation that she has.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, yes, that's very true. But they talked about the idea of having Snowdrop give her sagely advice through nightmares with Alpi, and I think that's a really cool idea.
Yeah, that seems more doable for sure. Although I did think it was funny that, like, Avery's first thought was, like, ticketing systems, which is just, like, the most un-goblin shit I've ever heard in my life. Like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's going to be, like, they sort of talk like, oh, yeah, there sure is a lot to figure out or whatever. I don't know. I'm going to be interested to see the other side of that conversation because I think it's more than Avery's maybe realizing.
Yeah, I agree. We'll have to see how they tackle it. This is going to be something that they have in Pale colon future after they beat Charles at the end of this arc.
Yeah. Because I think Pale will end, but then there's going to be just about four more years worth of just the Kennedys just living their best lives. Like, I'd read it.
Avery and Toadie start talking about wobbling in the face of adversity.
Yeah, and I found it super interesting that, like, Toad Swallow is the one that Avery has this chat with. Like, I guess just because she's...
How dare you? Toad Swallow is a great teacher.
I mean, he absolutely nails it, but I guess, like, it's just... Especially because he's, you know, the kind of goblin flavor of it still. Like, it's just not usually her first port of call. And, he has been, pretty important advisoral force in the past for her. Like, I remember that there was a lot of, like, when she was moving, he was the first one she told and stuff. So, like, it's not like it came out of nowhere, but I guess it's just feels like it's interesting that he is, I guess, the first one she talks to, especially because Verona was also, she went immediately to Toadie, but came at him with a very different vibe. It is a real testament to how good Toad Swallow is that he kind of manages to handle both of them to some degree, despite the fact they need completely opposite things from him.
Toad Swallow is the best. He's my favorite. I love him.
He nails it. Like, I like how when Verona came at him in 23.2, he was very much like, yeah, the parents forced it, but we kind of agree, and I, like, told her what she needed to hear. And he does the same sort of thing with Avery here, and even kind of calls out. She's like, oh, that's very goblin advice. And he's like, well, you're asking me. Like, you clearly subconsciously want it.
There's this interesting bit. Toadie kind of talks about how he's resigned to his fate of being forgotten, even though he is working to change goblin kind for the better. I mean, it's like, it's sad, but it is another point towards the kind of nobleness and overall wonderfulness of Toadie.
Yeah, there's a sad noble. It's like the anti-Bristow thing, right? Like Bristow would let, or Alexander maybe is even a better comparison. Like, those guys would make sure that they had to get all the accolades and they'd sink the ship. Like, we saw that right before Alexander got headshot. He was actively trying to sink everything because he couldn't be on top.
Yeah.
So especially I remember when the Blue Heron stuff was going on, everyone used to talk about Toad Swallow being the next headmaster. And it's just like another moment of comparison between him and some of the ex-headmasters of seeing that, yeah, he would be better. I also, I particularly wanted to call out this one line. He says, when he's talking about the goblins, and he says, like, I understand them. They're not very complicated. And then the next line is just Ram Jam wandered into the room. I just thought it was a very funny way to prove his point. Ram Jam's a simple boy.
Yeah. and immediately starts throwing out some very simple things like, do you want me to... can't remember exactly.
I'll do it. Says,
but yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah, I can't remember. He volunteers for something. Don't remember what, but that's... I don't think he...
It's classic Ram Jam.
Yeah, exactly.
Avery and her family then look for a path to use to get home, and Sheridan keeps on being her regular self, even as her life is very much in danger.
I could read so much content that's just family field trips to the paths. Like, this was so fun. The like, wait, this felt like a weird, magical, bastardized family vacation. Like, the bickering, like, this feels like a family walking into a museum, you know, or at least maybe my family's just dysfunctional. But this reminded me of us going to the museum while we're on holiday or something, you know? I loved it. I could totally read more of Avery trying to take the whole family to the paths.
It's a bit where they're in the keyways and Sheridan is just kind of like grumpily being impatient as she waits for Avery to turn her breathing back on. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like that's it. The sibling energy and just like giving her a look as you suffocate to death is so powerful.
So good.
And then immediately switching sides, because then they count, like they sort of come out of it, and Rowan's like, oh my god, I didn't have my blindfold on and I saw a bunch of stuff I wasn't meant to. And Sheridan's just then like, yeah, geez, Avery, wait for Rowan to get his blindfold on before you save our lives next time. It's just it's directionless, the attitude. I love it.
But yeah, so Avery does this thing where she tries and tells Sheridan about all the paperwork that some of the lower tier Garricks get saddled with as a way to try and discourage her. But like, it doesn't work. And I would happily do magical paperwork if it meant that I got magic powers. You know, like that's not a good disincentivization.
Especially because Sheridan brings up the super valid point that that's what a lot of jobs are anyway.
Exactly, and
like, given her athletic proclivities, she's going to end up with a desk job more likely than not anyway. So it's like, oh, geez, like, you know, would I rather manage some social media and do normal spreadsheets, or would I rather do magical spreadsheets?
Yeah,
like,
totally. It's an easy decision.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, this is a topic, like, this is where the story, I think, really starts to get into, because Rowan comes up and he's doing the opposite. Rowan is like, you know, boring as batshit and he wants to stay blindfolded. Like, the blindfolds are a very thin metaphor here. And this is where the story is really starting to bring this up, and we're going to get to talk about it a lot this week, because the idea of innocence and awareness is something that it looks like the story is shaping up to tackle pretty directly. And Rowan and Sheridan are kind of interesting examples of very overtly being raised, because Sheridan's diving headfirst in, much like we saw Melissa do, whereas Rowan is kind of choosing not to. And yeah, like, I think... getting ready to, it looks like, make some sort of thesis statement on what they think about awareness, and Sheridan and Rowan are going to be on the front lines of that.
It's interesting. What do you think of the keyways? Seems pretty lame in my opinion. It's just like unlocking a bunch of locks. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of dinguses would want to hang out in the keyways. You'd have to be a real loser. Take that, Hazel. Come at me.
No, she's not a loser. She was a finder, Elliot, I think.
I mean, it was the same when it came in 100 Years Lost. The keyways just sounds like a nightmare. Like, all that, all the fucking keyways, like, just no. I'd forget. I'd die. It's not worth it.
I agree.
I do think it's funny that, like, Kelsey is kind of the one to get the family trapped here too, because she, like, as she sort of says, she's like, oh, I was in a rush and I just didn't think. And I guess with all the talk going on at the moment of whether the parents were right to make the call about the Kenneteers because they need to parent the Kenneteers or something, it's a real, like, fucking teenage move by Kelsey here to just kind of rush
in. I know. It's so wild. She's just like, oh, I didn't really think it through. I ran into this crazy dangerous place where I can't breathe. Whoops. And the door closed behind us. Whoops.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's not doing her side of the argument much favors pulling that sort of shit. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. So parents shouldn't be on the paths. Let's lock that in.
So Avery is back in time for Jim, but has to navigate slotting back into her life and the existing tension with Nora.
Yeah, and it's the start of, like, this section is a very funny almost backslide for Avery, because she just, like, she doesn't reach out. Like, she sees Nora's kind of awkward and she's like, whoop. Better just go and be quiet on the other side of the gym. And then, like, in the changing room, she's like, better go into the corner and not make eye contact with someone. I was like, Jesus, Avery, like, you've been down this road before. Don't do this again. And obviously she gets pulled out of it. We'll get to talk about that. But it's really funny. It's just the backsliding energy off of her in this.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. it's interesting. I guess we'll get to this bit in a second, but it feels like if Putnam wasn't there, they would have just kind of broken up by default. It's really wild.
Which would be like, well, honestly, that's how my first teenage relationship ended, is we just kind of stopped talking because it got awkward.
Mm.
Thank God for Putnam, I guess. But yeah, as you said, we'll talk about that when she gets there.
Yeah. But yeah, I love that there's this teacher who has enough knowledge of physiotherapy that the magical hand waving of this world doesn't work on her.
Yeah, I think what makes it funny is how much Avery's like, oh, is this like karma? Or like, is it because I'm lost and the universe is conspiring? It's like, no, this woman just read Shattered Pelvis a couple of days ago and went,
what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah. Like, to talk about the Kelsey side of things, where Kelsey maybe wasn't making the best case for her side, Avery's immediately returning the favor, because it's like, no, you clearly need parenting, because it's like, you just wanted to start running again. And maybe she could because of the like magic and shit, but it's just like, it's so like, this teacher's stance is so incredibly reasonable, and it's such a statement of like how far gone Avery kind of is, that she's like, is this some sort of conspiracy to keep me from running? It's like, no, you just almost died. Like, no conspiracy needed.
Mm. Yeah. The teacher's very much in the right, right? Like,
yeah.
Even without knowing about Avery's magical healing, like, she still should take it a little bit easy.
Yeah, like 100%. Even with the magical stuff, I'm willing to bet that this teacher is right and that Avery's prone to re-injury if she pushes herself too hard here. Like, I reckon the magic is not covering her from that. Because it's so, like, this is so, I guess as someone who was an athlete as a teenager, like, this is very teenage athlete, the idea of it's like, well, I'm better now, so I'm just going to, like, go back to going 100%. Like, I knew so many people who would just, like, re-injure their knee or their shoulder because they'd injured it and then went back too hard the second it was kind of better. So, like, I think that's the other thing from this teacher's perspective is, like, Avery is exactly the kind of kid who would just continuously re-injure this pelvis over and over again because she kept doing this. So, like, this teacher is just, she just has her completely nailed. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, then we get to this scene where they're having lunch, and Putnam, with her intentional kind of obstinateness, helps to break the tension between the two of them. Well done.
Yeah. Like, Avery reintroduces Putnam as, like, the half-fairy girl on the team. And while I do see that, there's clearly a bit of, like, this directness feels much more goblin to me, where Putnam, like, she has all the subtlety of a brick here, where she's like, oh, well, you have to sit here and I have to sit here. So, oh, Nora, I guess you've got to sit next to Avery. Like, it works. It's so funny. But I was like, Avery, this is the least fae shit I've ever seen. Like, this is so, so direct.
Yep. Yeah. Works very well. There's this very funny bit where Sheridan comes over and says, Snowdrop packed our lunch or whatever. And Nora's like, what? Sheridan thought she was being clever or subtle when she really wasn't. It's just so good. But then she does cover for it pretty well by making up this thing about it being an in-joke with her family.
Yeah, it is good. But wait, I feel like that's probably the Kelly, the Kelly catchphrase at this point is, I thought I was being clever or subtle, but I wasn't. Like, that kind of applies not just to Sheridan. I think that's a family trait.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like, this moment's so good. Like, because then, yeah, we get the, like, wait, Snowdrop packed the lunch. Like, oh, fuck. And then it's so good. Like, yeah.
Mm.
Should we just get into it?
Yeah. So, did Wild Boat do this to us intentionally, do you think? Do you think Wild Boat thought, they're going to need more weird food options for All Packed Up 2. So let's get into it, you know?
But there was the...
also, by the way, making sure that there were at least some vegetarian options.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. You can't get out of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was the sibling bondage reference in this chapter, which,
yeah.
You know, everyone who's listened to Pale in Comparison will remember their tales of family bondage. and Wobbo has said that, like, that wasn't an intentional reference. Like, it had clearly just, like, sat in his subconscious
in his brain, yeah,
and sort of come out. So maybe that's what happened here, is just subconsciously Wobbo is thinking of ways to torture us as he would his characters in All Packed Up 2. I do think it's right. Do you remember the idea we had for the brownies that we were going to do? This was like, yep, back when
I
we
still
thought,
think we should do that. I think that would be,
oh yeah,
delightful.
But now I think we turn it more into this. So just to give everyone, we were going to have the brownies, this, which was basically, and my mum and I did a trial of this. I don't know if you remember the video.
No, I don't remember.
My mum and I baked a brownie, and then in every slice we put in a different filling. So, like, one had caramels, one had choc chip, but then one had toothpaste, one had wasabi, one had ketchup. And so the idea was, is, you know, like, we might get told to eat a piece of brownie, and it's a complete lucky dip whether you get something, yeah, really nice or fucking horrendous.
Yeah.
And that was a really fucking loose tie to the brownies, if we're being perfectly honest, whereas, like, this Lost thing is just made for that. Like, like, yeah, we absolutely need to do something like that where you get lucky dip food.
Mm. Yeah, I think that would be pretty fun. This reminds me of that Taskmaster task in the Victoria Corin Mitchell season where they have to eat the bags of food and guess what it is. And there's, like, one that's like nachos and Nutella, and there's one that's like mayonnaise and Marmite and stuff like that, you know?
Mm.
That's what this really gave me vibes of.
Well, there's, I mean, there's been a few of those on Taskmaster. Like, the one that came up in my live read was the one where there was the pies, and there was, like, the toothpaste pie and marble, oh,
yeah,
pie.
Yeah.
There was another one where they did ice cream flavors that were wacky.
Mm, yeah.
Recently.
Anyway. It's a classic, isn't it? Figure,
yeah,
out what's
it is.
This weird food.
Yeah, we'll need to do it. I agree. This is an immediate, like, well, this is an All Packed Up Too thing.
Yeah.
But I guess to get back to the story, I do love, like, Avery's still very much in, like, erecting a shell mode at the moment. Like, she's kind of still backsliding and kind of, like, trying to slip through the cracks a bit as she's is a bit lost. But she does such a shit job of it because she's like, oh, I don't really want to talk about it. I just, you know, I almost bled to death and I've been in hospital.
Mm.
And it's like, after she says that, there's this thing where it's like, well, that elicited more questions. And it's like the narration almost makes it sound like she's a little surprised at this reaction, as if that isn't, like, by far the most interesting story anyone at this table is ever going to hear and needs more information on. Like, it, and then, yeah, and then she brings out all this food and, like, at first she's like, oh God, what has Snowdrop done? But like, this heals herself more than food would have, because it forces her to actually, like, talk to everyone, and she sets up this trading thing. It turns into a whole, like, community event and gets her more food. Like, it's so good.
Mm.
Like, it's such a positive moment as well as being fun to read.
Yeah. yeah, definitely. It's nice. It's really nice. So, yeah, we get into, we're getting into next Avery debriefing on her day with Lucy. And getting romantic advice from a few different angles.
Some more helpful than others.
Mm-hmm.
I do love, like, Lucy joins the list of people in this chapter who kind of have to tell Avery she's being an idiot for feeling insecure about contributing right now.
Mm.
And I don't know, I most related to Lucy's variant on it here, which is just like, Lucy's version is like, essentially, you can't be fucking serious. Like, you just did so much. You need to recover. What the fuck are you talking about? Which is, like, exactly how I feel like I would talk to Avery right now if she was like, I'm just worried I'm not contributing.
Yeah, like, take a single break.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we get into, at the end, a bit of a conversation about changing awareness, because Kelsey brought it up from their conversation with Miss, and it kind of sticks in Avery's head as a potential, I don't know, angle of attack, I guess, or way to shake up the landscape. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think? like, because obviously this is how the parents became the Awareans, and that has, like, worked out pretty well, right? Was, like, the town of Kennet was made easier for people to become aware, and then that led directly to the parents becoming aware, right? So, yeah, I don't know. It's, like, a shake-up for sure, but not necessarily a bad one.
Yeah, I feel like it was a month or two ago we had a conversation on the podcast where it was like, I don't think it's within the realm of the story, but I'd love to see the Kenneteers kind of make a thesis statement on what they think awareness should be. And now it actually looks like we are heading in that direction because, yeah, Avery, the way this closes it, it seems like this is very much something Avery's planning to tackle.
Mm.
And it comes up a lot in the next chapter too, so I don't know how much we want to talk about it there as well, but... It's very interesting. Avery seems to be talking about challenging the assumptions, like the part that everyone assumes is a fact about awareness, but doesn't actually have to be.
Mm.
And she seems to very specifically be thinking about the whole responsibility angle. But I think something interesting that comes up in the next chapter is the idea that, like, you're kind of rewarded for not being aware in this world. And, like, maybe awareness doesn't necessarily have to be compulsory or whatever, but, like, I'd love a world where, like, awareness is an advantage, like, in the innocent world, if that makes sense. Like, if they can somehow spin something along those lines, that seems like a positive.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, because it's a stupid system that being aware hurt. Like, when you know, and the next chapter shreds this metaphor to bits, but if you view awareness as a metaphor for being, like, a person who is aware of, like, other minorities' issues, like, it's bullshit that being aware of those issues hurts you in the innocent world.
Mm.
So, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting thread that we'll see picked up at some point through this arc. So I look forward to seeing what their plan around that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then we have... Go for the Throat 23.4 from Lucy's perspective. She's on a fun camp out with the dogs and everything goes great.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, they are just having a good time at the start, at
That's
least.
True. That is how it starts.
Although, like, I not to be a stick in the mud, but I was really on Lucy's page with this whole breast pump story. Like, Pipes hyped it up as very funny and, like, then he reveals that Bidas had a breast pump, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't find it funny at all. I was like, never related more to Lucy than just kind of sitting there being like, I don't see why that's funny.
Mm. Yeah.
Wait, I don't know. I find it fascinating that War would equip a dog with a breast pump that he doesn't need.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think Grandfather makes a point later or says, like, effectively, they've spent all their time focused on War, so they don't have enough context to go beyond being a teenager about some things.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't think of myself as having a particularly mature sense of humor. And even I was just like, oh, fascinating.
Mm.
Are there other uses for breast pumps I'm unaware of? Because that could be funny.
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway.
but.
Yeah. Sorry, I guess the other thing to talk about here is So Midas shoots Pipes and gets in trouble for it.
Mm.
And I was 100% on Team Midas here. Like, Pipes was all but literally asking for it. Like, Midas made it very clear he did not want this story told. Pipes went ahead. He knew what he was he knew what he was getting into.
Mm.
Like, I'm Team Midas for once.
Yeah,
Midas agree. Has generally been the shit cunt, but, like, I'm fully on his team here. Pipes had that coming.
Yes. Team Midas shooting Pipes for this shenanigans. And then, you know, the story, I guess, validates Pipes because Midas gets killed. So, you know, guess Pipes was right, according to Wabo.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We might see Midas. Wait, this is the weird. Midas has been the one who's the touchiest around the Kenneteers. So that's, I don't know. Maybe he just didn't want to get summoned by them.
He was like, no, I'm good here, thanks. I'll just hang out with the black scalpel.
But yeah, I don't know. I just people talking about it was the gun too much and like grandfather and horseman were like, yeah, we don't shoot each other. It's like, I don't know. They're dogs, right? It's like, it's the equivalent of like a nut tap or something. Like, I don't know. He was asking for it.
Mm.
Like, And yeah, because they're all like, oh, Pipes is still recovering from being horrified. You shouldn't do that to him. It's like, well, then he shouldn't shit stir other people. Like, I don't know. Like, that's still on him. Anyway, sorry, I will die on this hill. I'm defending Midas.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is kind of a nice camaraderie vibe, right?
Yeah.
I love, have we met Whistle before? There's a dog with a dog. It's so nice. But yeah, Lucy's kind of hanging out. She's a bit outside of it. She doesn't fully belong to war yet, but, you know, still there and having a good time.
Yeah, like, I agree. Seeing her sort of start to edgy, like, I thought it was very funny that she's like, you know, oh, they're such a tight-knit group. And, you know, like, it is really fun seeing them all banter. And then Lucy's like, I can't quite belong as a part of that, though, because what if I make an awkward joke and then it like ruins it, which is a vibe I very much get. Like, I think we've all been there, like not wanting to be the guy who says the awkward joke that ruins the whole vibe or whatever. But it's like, I don't know how many coats these guys need to give you before you realize you're not one awkward joke away from ruining everything, Lucy. Like, yeah, extremely understandable, but also big dingus energy from Lucy.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so Lucy has a bit of a D&M with Horseman and Grandfather about innocence and war and familiarship.
Yeah. And this is where, like, the story just kind of really peels away the metaphor of what awareness is, I think, because Lucy kind of immediately pivots from talking about awareness in the story to like, yeah, but what about people who just ignore like racism and poverty and stuff in the real world?
Mm.
So, like, we're very much not allowed to just engage with only the magical side of it. Like, yeah, destroying that line. And, yeah, like, I mean, it's very hard not to. I kind of instinctively agree with, like, Lucy's POV that it's, like, shitty that if this bad stuff is happening, there are people out there who are allowed to just be innocent and, like, not aware of it and not engage with it and potentially even be rewarded for not doing so.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. There's a lot of really interesting points made in this section, and I think they tie into a bit of what we're talking about in our discussion question with the parents and making the decision of whether to let the kids fight or not, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's really interesting that it's the soldier animi or animuses who are kind of making the counterpoint to Lucy here, because, like, as kind of soldiers, they're like the perfect people to bring up this counterpoint to Lucy, that they're like, well, maybe part of the reason some of us fight is so that there can be those, you know, happy, fat, ignorant idiots. Like, to a degree, that's what we're fighting for in a way.
Mm.
And this comes up explicitly in the thing, but like, especially the dogs, who are the people that don't have that part of themselves. Like, they're just the soldier part. They don't have the family back home. There's like, they're kind of the perfect people to raise this point of like, well, part of what we're fighting for is to give everyone else more of those moments where they don't have to face the ugly side of life.
Mm.
So I think it's really, I really liked the choice of them being the ones to counter Lucy's incredibly, for me at least, relatable perspective of fuck that there are people who are allowed to just be unaware of this stuff.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a complex question, isn't it? How much fighting should one person who wants to fight be allowed to do?
Yeah. Like, how do you, I mean, this is what kind of been Lucy's journey throughout the entire story of Paleys. How do you balance those two sides of life? And like, this has also been a big thing between her and Jazz, because like, Jazz has long been, like, Jazz's refrain has long been, I didn't want this to be the world for Lucy. Like, I wanted, you know, the Lucy with the pigtails and the hearts in her overalls or whatever it was. Like, she wanted Lucy to have a good life, and it's always seemed a little bit unrealistic for Jazz to think that. Mm-hmm. I've always certainly thought so. But I think the dogs make probably a better case than I think Jazz ever has for why that's fair from Jazz's perspective, which is like, Jazz has seen the world as worse, and like, it's gotten better throughout Jazz's lifetime. Like, Jazz, you know, talks a lot about how she doesn't use physical violence on her kids because her parents did that to her and she hates them for it. So it's like, she has made a better world for Lucy, and it's like, you can kind of see why it's like, I don't want you to be fighting so much, when it's like, yeah, the world isn't perfect, but it's so much better and I did that for you. Like, I think it'd be really interesting for Lucy to consider, and it's kind of what the dog's raised here, but like if Lucy had a daughter, how much would she want her daughter to do what she's doing?
Mm.
Versus how much would she want her daughter to be happy?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I really think the idea of like Jazz is obviously, you know, Lucy got this fighting for justice vibe from Jasmine to an extent, right? Like I think Jasmine has had a lot of these same experiences and still doesn't want Lucy's life to be defined just by fighting injustice. She wants her to have a happy life too.
Yeah. And so I think this is like the best case. Like I love how these threads are kind of colliding like this because this is not just tying into this whole thing that's been going on with awareness and Lucy and like what's the middle ground there, but coming into like Jazz and stuff. And I'm kind of like, oh, I see. Yeah. The argument that the dogs are making that it's like, there's probably always going to be some fight to be had. Like there's all, you know, the world, the utopia without any injustice that's worth fighting is a very long way away. And how are we fighting in the meantime? I mean, that's been a huge thing for Pale, and I love that it's bouncing off all these other threads that are sort of circling around Lucy.
Mm. Yeah.
Particularly a few chapters after Jasmine specifically called out the dogs as, in her opinion, a symbol of Lucy becoming more part of war. Like, you know, the dogs have, like, we've always known the dogs weren't very warish, particularly these dogs, because John got them remade so that they weren't that warish. But like, I guess, you know, right after Jazz calls out more time with the dogs as Lucy becoming less hers and more wars, I think it's interesting that we are seeing the dogs very much saying, yo, chill out on this.
Mm.
Less of us, please. And my also, I think Lucy very much frames the dogs as like the aspect of her fighting that is like perseverance and determination and grit. Like the dogs are like, she will keep going, she will not stop fighting. And it's the dogs here who are actually kind of being like, hey, don't always be like that though. Sometimes you need to chill out. Like, like every kind of box that these dogs get put in, they kind of fight against it themselves. Like, you know, they're right up next to Toadslaw and someone's like people who are fighting against the category they're putting into, and that's what's so fun about them.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's fun that they're the ones. You're right, it really adds to it. Now can we talk
about proves that they're people, like they're not, you know, they're not just symbols of what I think Jazz's concerns are valid and like even a little bit true, but like not the whole picture, and that's what I love about it.
Can we talk about the familiar ship? Grandfather is familiar. What do you think?
I don't, like, even with everything Lucy's saying and stuff, it's still hard not to view it as like, well, I couldn't get John, so this will do energy, which is like, I know that's not what it is, but I don't know. Mm. It's complicated.
Yeah, that's my reaction too. Like, I don't know. It's hard to not feel like it's a replacement John.
And it's not, like, it's she's not, been so explicit that it's not, but like, yeah, you can't unsee it, can you? I don't know. I do agree with her general sentiment, like the general case for why she wants a dog of war in a general sense as a familiar. That part really lands, like the whole, you know, some extra healing, harder to dinus, like a dog, a friend, like there's a reason Lucy has continuously gravitated towards the dogs throughout this story. Like that part all adds up, but it's still like the ghost of John still looms to a degree.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And you can't, how can you get past that? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, Cause this is the, like, I guess the whole thing with Lucy and the dogs since arc 14, like I remember when she kind of got with the dog pack and like, Grandfather was clearly much more juvenile to John, and like they've had a much more equal relationship than John ever has. Like I think Lucy gives the dog tags as much as they give her. Lucy's just liable to forget that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas that wasn't necessarily as much the case with John. Mm-hmm. So I think like that's maybe the way, like if I see much more what it makes so much more sense to me what Grandfather gets out of it as opposed to John, I suppose. Like if there was more emphasis on why it's good for Grandfather in a way it wouldn't have been for John, that helps make it feel less like it's just substitute John.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know if it can ever feel like not substitute John just by virtue of
circumstances. Does it have to? Is the other question. Like, to a degree, that might just be us holding onto an image and it's just like, well, fuck that opinion. Like, who cares?
Yeah. But yeah, so Lucy heads to bed and sets up some extra security as she does so, which is a good move.
Yeah, I mean, it's needed, but not necessarily that helpful. I do love, like, as we get into this fight, Lucy pulls out this new fucking ability she has that she's been sleeping on, which is she has a move to measure power levels. Like, that's really cool. And also adds a lot of hype to this fight because she's just immediately like, yeah, this thing's stronger than Guillemette, which is a bit of an oh fuck moment.
Yeah. That is a wild moment, isn't it? This fight is crazy. This thing's wild.
It's so fun and it's so gnarly. I love the way it starts peeling people's faces off and wearing them. Like, like full horror movie. Like, the Abyss is so cool. But yeah, this just becomes, it goes from a group camping out in the forest to just being a horror movie. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty wild. Black Scalpel is like swinging around in the trees, throwing bodies and faces at people. Like, it's crazy.
And it moves weird. I love that the scalpel is almost the kind of center of gravity when it wants it to be. So it lets it like move uncannily. That's a great horror trope like not moving correctly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the part, I love the bit where Lucy has to run to the car and like can't really get the car started and she doesn't fit in it properly because she's a 14-year-old. Like, that's just straight out of a horror movie. The like 14-year-old running and like trying to start the car to get away from the bad guy. Like, just at every turn, it's just great.
And
delightfully gory. I wonder if this puts Lucy off horror movies at all, living stuff like this.
Yeah, maybe. I love they're making some progress against the scalpel finally, and then it just kind of casually bounce passes the scalpel to Angel, who gets up and starts fucking revamped attacking. It's just like, yeah, this is the kind of thing that Charles will just casually let loose on the world. Good times.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of dinguses. I also love the fake arena that Lucy does, like, to get a bit of respite. She puts her and Mark in an arena. And it's just like, the rule is first blood. And then when they're ready to go, she just, like, gives him a light stabbing. Very funny.
Yeah. A little quick poke with a rapier. Lucy and the dogs manage to escape from this fight with everyone except Midas seemingly safe. And they continue on to meet the Sable. So, yeah, what's going on with Midas? You think Midas is, like, dead?
I got the vibe that he just wasn't responding to the dog tags because he's a dick.
You think?
Yeah, just the way there's like the reaction Lucy has when Verona is like, I can't get Midas. Lucy thinks, oh God, he's such a pain in the ass, which would be a shit thing to think if he's like dead.
True.
So I think he's just being a bit of a, difficult, whatever. I mean, it's his call. I guess we'll see. We only just got him though. It'd be a shame to lose him already.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of difficult pains in the ass, the Sable. This fucking guy, like, it's just, this is one of those interactions where I was, like, reading it, and I was like, thank God I get to read this chapter twice, because this dude just makes it so hard to follow the train of conversation. He, like, deliberately makes shit difficult to interpret. Like, his whole, what is your favor and what is your intent? And Lucy's like, oh, I'm here for a conversation. And then he has this brief conversation with her and he's like, well, that was the favor. What's your intent? I was like, oh, fucking hell, dude. Like, he seems to be intentionally difficult.
Yeah.
Like, very fun, but like, I wanted to punch him in the face.
Is pretty annoying. Yeah.
Very annoying.
And
like, I don't know. Like, it feels like he intentionally drives the conversation in directions that makes it difficult to remember what we're talking about. Like, I at least kind of struggled to remember. Like, somehow we went from Lucy saying, "Are you siding with Charles?" to then they're like talking about why what Charles did is wrong, and it just kind of like, it reached this point in the conversation where I was a bit like, "Wait, what exactly is the question we're even answering anymore?" And I feel like he does that sort of thing intentionally. Yeah, like, I especially, I don't know, like, I think I called this out like a while ago. Like, I'm incredibly incredulous about his whole like neutrality vibe, and like I feel like most of the questions he asks Lucy here, he should know the answer to. Like, I don't think he's asking them because he needs the information from Lucy. He wants to hear Lucy say it.
Yeah, it is a weird vibe. It's hard to say, like, how much is Sable, I don't know, not on side versus just being a spirit that can't quite connect.
He seems to be intentionally obfuscating any ability to, like, understand his perspective, which is frustrating, I guess, as a reader. But like, I just couldn't help but get the read that he's like everything. It feels like he's goading people, like testing them somehow. Like, this felt more like a conversation with the Page of Sons than it does another judge. The thing I keep coming back to is the whole thing with him kind of quote unquote stabbing Charles in the back with Avery's death was that really felt like he was doing some weird test of Charles. Like, he sort of, you know, he had that whole thing where he was like, oh, I, you know, don't presume. But no, it's not Verona. And then that was when Charles was like, oh, it's Avery. Avery's dead. Oh, no. And like shot himself in the foot. And it was like this weird kind of test of character. And it feels like he's testing Lucy here. And I guess I'm just kind of sitting here being like, but to what end? Like, what are you after? He seems to care about the quality of other judges. Like, we know he chose John. And to some degree, he's a little ticked off about John not getting the role. But like, yeah, what? I don't know. Like, this is still the thing. Like, I'm like, I don't buy the Sable's neutrality. He has his own agenda. It seems to be something to do with wanting good judges or something, but like, why and what are you testing people like? Was, yeah, anyway, just, I can't wait to see what I assume is the second half of this conversation in 23.5, because I want to understand him better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll get more of this convo and I look forward to it. But yeah, this chapter ends on a bit of a bombshell, which is that judges have received an offer to kind of legitimize them from outside world powers, and it seems likely that it's going to be taken, which is fucked. The Kennedys have done so much. Finally, they're starting to win. They're finally starting to win, and then suddenly some out-of-towny lords come in and just completely fuck that up. Like, what?
I mean, the worst part, though, like the part that really gets my goat about it is I was just like, oh, of course, though. Like, of course, like this just sounds like, you know, if there's some civil war in a corner of the world, the UN sort of steps in and makes peace or whatever, and that usually comes to legitimizing whoever's currently in power or whatever. Like, it reeks of the way the West or the UN interfere in these kinds of civil wars. I just immediately bought this was happening, and that's the worst part. And like, yeah, what does this mean too? Like, legitimacy in what sense? Like, I think that's a really fascinating question. Is I can't help but look at this and think like it might tie into all of Musa's lordships or something, because we've heard that like Canada/American practice is still very Wild West.
Yes.
And if this is all these old places like Paris and stuff, I assume those places are like lordshipped and codified to a degree, like, you know, built well on top of the seal, but there is like presumably some kind of UN-y equivalent. I guess this is the equivalent of like saying this region is recognized by the UN or whatever. Like, if you're recognized as a UN government, that gives you certain international abilities. That I guess what's interesting about this is, did this region have that legitimacy before the story started? Because I kind of get the vibe the answer is no. It's like, what abilities does this give the judges that they didn't have before?
I feel like
we're going to learn some interesting stuff about other systems built on top of the seal.
I think probably the biggest thing is going to be, like, we know that the lack of access to power is what has really started to turn the tide on Charles, right? They don't have the Alabaster's power bank anymore. So maybe this is just another way for Charles to get enough power to do his shittiness, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, because presumably we're going to get to see some of this deliberation with the Sable next chapter, so this is going to be very fun. And Lucy's just such a fun person to be involved in that discussion. This is great.
Yeah.
Again, I can't help but think that it's not an accident that the Sable, you know, she rocked up just in time. I don't believe anything this boy does is an accident. He's got his agenda.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the end of our chapters this week. Whew, spicy point to leave it, especially when we know there's another chapter that has just come out very recently that we haven't had time to read.
I know. I feel like I've probably just said a bunch of shit that's very wrong, and I can't wait to find out what.
Mm. Yeah. But yeah, so let's get into our part of the show where we talk about some comments that folks have left in our Pale Predictor form or on the Reddit threads. I put out a prediction by a new predictor, I think, Adilio.
Adilio?
Oh, I don't think there's an I in there, maybe.
Well, that's the Y. Yeah, anyway.
Adilio. Yeah, maybe. But talking about how the Kennedys plan to not, you know, kill Charles, but fuck with him a bit more actively. Basically, Dillo is talking about whether the practitioners, the Kennedys, will give Charles an ultimatum of back off and kind of chillax or not, as a mirror to the deal that Charles offered the trio before the war of, like, back off and you can keep Kennet in exchange for not coming after me more, which I think is interesting. I'm kind of curious of the question of, do you think that the Kennedys will still give Charles an out, or have we gotten beyond that point by now?
Well, Lucy brings up at the end of 23.4, and it's an idea I've been in love with since Verona pitched it a couple of arcs ago, which is trapping Charles in the role and forcing him to fix it. Like, that's his community service, right? It's not punitive, it's restorative. Like, yeah, you made this mess, clean it up. Like, that's, like, if we're committing to not following in Charles's footsteps but kind of still going for an eye for an eye methodology, I love that the eye for an eye might be make up for the bad shit you did in a positive way. Like, so I've been fully on board that train for a while, and I hope that's just, yeah, I agree. I love the idea of cornering Charles and basically forcing him to agree to an external mandate. So it's like, you get to keep this position, but we're binding you to do it in a particular way. I think that would be fair.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm really curious of, do you think they will give Charles options, you know?
I think they'll have to some degree. I mean, to a degree, they can't ever take away the option of, you know, taking himself out of the equation, so to speak. But I don't know. I don't think there'll be that much flexibility. I think they'll, like, you know, this contract won't outline everything. Like, the role and life itself always has to have some degree. But I think there will be, I think a lot of it, I would guess, would be fairly set in stone. Like, you have to, you know, do certain things.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. But yeah, do you have a comment you want to pull out?
Oh yeah. I've got one from the Reddit thread on chapter 23.4. This was by Fubo, and Fubo just says, apropos of nothing, if Engine Head and the murder truck met, wouldn't that be bad?
Nah, it'd be funny.
Engine Head powered murder truck. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, that would be a fun arc villain.
Yeah. No, I like it. I like it. Yeah. As Zizzard says in chat, it's a new ship for sure.
I love that. Yeah. Get Putnam on it.
Yeah.
Cool. Should we get into our discussion question?
Yeah, we should. The discussion question for last week was, did the Awareans do the right thing? What role should they have as parents?
Yeah.
Where should we start? I mean,
yeah, this is a trick. Everyone wrote so much for this one.
Yeah, I think this is going to be tricky. A lot of people were very passionate about, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's also this stuff. I think there's just a lot to consider and a lot of nuance in, like, any answer. Like, you can't, like, you know, the whole reason the story is tackling this question is because it's not an easy one. So it's also, like, it's hard to just do a one sentence summary answer. So what we're going to do is take all of the answers that didn't do it and bastardize them down to that anyway. Starting with Old Lace One, who I guess essentially the main thrust of their answer was that the parents missed their chance to pull the girl. Like, this is a war, and the parents have seen how much of a war it is. And basically it's crazy that they think that their kids can just get out of it and not be in danger, and they need to suck it up and engage.
Yeah. I don't know about this.
They brought up like you know, Charles
was very open about what he was going to do, and it was clearly a war. And so if they wanted to pull the girls out, they should have done that 3 months ago, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's just like they didn't know enough about this situation. They were still kind of getting their bearings. Like, are they not – if that was a failure before, they're not allowed to correct it ever? I don't know.
I also think – I kind of disagree with Old Lace's logic of the idea of the parents hearing that a mad god has said he will kill their daughters to get what he wants. So the parents' reaction should be, oh, this is a noble fight that I want my 14-year-old daughters to be a part of. Like, I think the reaction to hearing a mad god saying that he will kill anyone who gets in his way is to say, well, my daughters will not be in your way then. Like, so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, and I feel like this is going to be my reaction to every answer we get tonight, but it's like, yes, but also no, I guess. Like, I'm inherently uncomfortable with the idea of saying, well, they should have done it then, so now they don't get to. Like, I liked what I thought the parents were very fair when they were like, well, yeah, it has gone on too long, and now if we try to do it, it's because of our fuck ups, and we're going to permanently hurt our relationship with our kids, but maybe that's what we need to do. And I can't help but agree with that stance of like, yeah, look, better late than never, and it's going to hurt our relationship with them, but that's worth it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Well, first of all, I loved Old Lace's response just because I think it was a bold statement that I quite liked. It was a unique perspective. But it's very interesting, like, a lot of people didn't like the secrecy, right? I think that was the theme through a lot of these responses. That was Landis963, like, thinks, okay, it's a fair concept, but they should have been more upfront about it. Uncle Thermoscales, like, it's fair, but they're being secret, so that's what pushes it over. It's like they gave the Kennet others a chance, right? Like, they gave the Kennet others a chance to let this war be fought with the assumption that eventually it would be finished. And it just doesn't seem like we're getting to that point without them taking action, you know? So them needing to act in secrecy is a forced move by the Kennet others not letting it conclude, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I know Uncle Thermoscales brought this up in particular, but like, the main idea I think behind the secrecy of the move is that it's essentially they want the right not to be the bad guys. Like, the parents want to do this, but they, you know, in an effort to save their relationships with their kids, they wanted it to be less them enforcing this on the kids and more collaborative. And I think that's really interesting because, to a degree, I think the Kennet others have kind of happily gotten on board with that point. The Kennet others agree to the point where, like, when the Kennet, like, well, Toady straight up said to Verona, was like, oh, the parents made you do this. And Toady was like, hey, look, they forced it.
They're copying for sure.
But we agreed to it because they're right. We agree. And so I think that, like, the interesting wrinkle to the whole secrecy angle is, like, I think there's an argument to be made of, like, okay, if it comes out, like, if Verona tells the other two girls and it's a bit like, wait, the parents did this, I think the Kennet others are going to be the first people to jump in between the Kenneteers and their parents and be like, hey, look, yeah, they forced it, but, like, they're right.
Yeah, right.
And that brings the whole concept of the secrecy of it to a really interesting point where I think, there's an argument to be made that maybe it's a sign that it wasn't a good idea to do it in secret, but I think you could argue it's as valid an idea without the secrecy. So does that matter? Like, I don't know. I like Uncle Thermoscales also made the point that, it's just you who's written this. Miss was deceitful in bringing the kids in.
Yes.
I really like that counterpoint.
Yeah. It was, I was kind of reading these and reacting to them myself. Like, and I had the thought, Miss was deceitful in bringing the kids in, so it's their responsibility to get the kids out, and the parents being deceitful to get that to happen is seems fair, you know, like not 100% on the level, sure, but fair. I think the one that I'm easily impressed wrote around this as well, like, we've asked the question of, is what the parents doing right? But really, the parents' hand is being forced by the Kennett Council failing the girls, right? Because the
Kennett, I love that.
The parents say, all the parents want is for the Kennett Council to step up and take more responsibility for this war. That's what they're arguing for. And the fact that the Kennett Council agrees to that implies that they weren't doing that, right? I mean, like, means that they weren't doing that. And so, like, the parents were right to ask for that. By that metric, right? Because what's happening is the Kenneteers are on the front lines when the rest of the Kennett Council aren't doing all that they can.
Yeah, which, like, I guess if we specifically focus in on less the war and more the parenting aspect, yeah, that, like, there is an argument to be made that the Kennett Council has done a shit job of not using these girls as weapons. And it is the parents who are coming in and saying, no more.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a really, fun angle to consider. I love that response.
Yeah. I think I really liked what Jay Maniac said, called out the point that, like, this plan isn't actually going to work because Verona's still going to, like, we know if Verona's magic gets cut off, she's not just going to stop. So therefore, it's not a good plan because it's not going to actually achieve what they want. I think that's a really good point.
I mean, yeah, like to a degree, you can't, like, that's inarguable.
Yeah.
Like, that is a good point. Although I think it's interesting. And I feel like this is the point that I end up circling around a lot when we have conversations about Verona and stuff, like going right back to all the relationship stuff that happened with her in, like, arcs 11 and 12 is, Jay's point about wanting parenting to be a lot more collaborative, I think that's often easier said than done. Like, for the parents' defense, one of the big things they brought up in 23.A is the girls are keeping a lot of information away from them. Like that just as much goes the other way. Like, if the kids don't want the parents pulling this shit, then they need to stop keeping secrets of their own. And like, you know, like Verona, I think, you know, in particular, like, yes, Verona is immediately going around this and this sort of thing, but I think efforts to sit down and talk about this collaboratively with Verona, I think 9 times out of 10 are going to go wrong because there's many justifiable pitfalls to avoid in conversations with Verona about this sort of thing. Like, it is exceptionally difficult to do that with someone, particularly like Verona.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of easier said than done, I guess, in the terms of, like, collaborating on this, because the parents are so right to know that they're not getting the whole picture.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I think there's only one other response that we had that we haven't talked about, which is from Gyroda, who says the parents were definitely entitled and could have gone further, but they probably should more actively bring in Sylvia.
Yeah. I think the Sylvia thing, I'm fine with where that's kind of at right now, which seems to be Jazz to some degree is pushing Verona in that direction. And it may amount to an ultimatum at some point, but I have no gripes to argue with in the Sylvia front at the moment, as long as it keeps going in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Good discussion question.
Yeah.
And now
I think we are both just realizing that we have not come up with another one.
Whoops. It's hard to do a discussion question when we know there's another chapter as well that we haven't read.
Yeah. I guess mild spoilers. You haven't read it either yet, I'm assuming, no. Right, Ruben? That's a fun one. Is this a divot?
There we go. Boom.
Definitely keeping that one in the back. But what do we want to do, something about awareness, or should we hold off on that maybe?
No, we just did a serious discussion question. Yes. Let's do a chill one.
Yeah. Okay. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I like this. Weird food combinations. We've done a lot of weird food ones, but they're just always so much fun.
Yeah. I like the idea of invent a new OS food, just because that gives us all packed up 2 ideas.
Yeah, I agree. I like it. Let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. So our new discussion question is, what's your idea for a lost food? Bonus marks if it's all packed up too compatible. So you can leave your answers to that in our discussion thread, which is linked in the show notes down below.
Yes, you can also check out our Twitter, where we stopped posting memes, but we started posting jokes every day. Funny jokes that everybody says, ha ha, when they read them.
Ha ha ha, that's what everyone will say to them. check out our Twitter. And also, if you want to check out more from the Doof Media Network, you can go to doofmedia.com, the website, which has all kinds of fun activities, if you can find them.
Yeah. Don't forget, it's also where the fan art results are. So mm-hmm. go look at fan arts there.
Yeah. Speaking of fan art, the only reason that we can run that fan art contest is because we have patrons who support us and let us do things like offer cash prizes for fan art contests.
Yep. And don't forget about Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo. Donate to him.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
and
what more do you need?
See everyone.
Bye.